What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. We are so excited to be here with you today. We have a great guest for you, someone who was praised a lot in last week's episode, Ivan Kachanovsky. Some of you may remember last week when we spoke about Canada's Ukrainian Nazi gate with Mark Ames and Yasha Levine and Lev Galinkin. They kept talking about how hard Ivan had worked on this project, how he had exposed the identity of this Ukrainian Nazi. So I realized that we should have Ivan on to talk about not just this incident, but also really important things that he's been working on. He has a really, I think, important insight into the war in Ukraine and also what happened in Maidan Square, and we'll get into that. So before I start, though, I want to welcome everyone and ask people to please hit the like. This is a way that you just show your gratitude. Hit the like button, share, and subscribe. And to subscribe, you hit subscribe and then press the bell. If you can become Patreon members, that's great at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And last week's episode, I gave you some of the chat that I did with Yasha Levine, Mark Ames, and Lev Galinkin, but the Patreon has a lot more. And we get into all sorts of really scary things that the CIA did and the Pope did with hiding war criminals. It's fascinating. It was really fun to talk with those three guys. And you basically get twice as much content when you're a Patreon supporter because you get an extended interview every week. Sometimes you get totally extra interviews that we don't even show you at all. So patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Make sure you do that. We're going to bring on our first guest. And again, as I said, I'm really, really excited to have him on. He is someone who, again, was praised last week by our guests for being so conscientious and so hardworking when it comes to kind of exposing the alt-right, the far-right, the neo-Nazi right, or maybe just the Nazi right in Ukraine. He teaches at the School of Political Studies and Conflict Studies and Human Rights Program at the University of Ottawa. He was visiting scholar at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian at Harvard University. He's the author of Cleft Countries, Regional Political Divisions and Cultures in Post-Soviet Ukraine and Moldova, and co-author of Historical Dictionary of Ukraine. So without any further ado, let us welcome Ivan Kachanovsky.
Thank you for the invitation. It's just a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
So we're going to get into everything that happened with Yaroslav Hunka. And of course, you exposed that story. And we're talking about the 98-year-old volunteer of the SS who received a standing ovation in the Canadian House of Commons. But I actually want to start off asking you some kind of more personal questions about your biography and your role as a dissident. So can you tell us a little bit about your academic trajectory and also how you've been a dissident and which different contexts you've been a dissident?
Yes, I think this is also maybe important to understand as a background to this story, because I was born in Western Ukraine. And my family was not involved in any political parties. They were not involved in any politics. But because of the politics, they affected their life. And my grandmother lived in 5 countries without moving to any country on her own. My mother lived in 4 countries without moving on her own as well.
So your grandmother lived in 4 countries without moving, or 2?
In 5.
In 5 countries. And your mother in?
In 4.
So they didn't move. It was the borders that moved around them.
Yes, exactly. And in one case, they were actually expelled from Poland, which is now Poland, Helm area of Poland, to Western Ukraine, to Volhynia region, or city of Lutsk, in former Czech colony. So they settled there. And actually, I found interesting documents. They were originally sent to Melitopol in Zaporizhia region, which is now in the middle of this counteroffensive. So this is like, so basically, kind of, even if you're not interested in politics, you were affected by the politics directly, and not just moving in the country, just for the sake of moving, but changing borders. My grandparents lost their house during World War II and all the property. They became refugees. In World War II, they faced execution by the Nazis, basically by giving bread for my grandfather had to dig his own grave next to his house because he gave a loaf of bread to prisoner of war from nearby camp who was Soviet prisoner of war. And at the time, this was caught by Nazis, and they wanted to execute my grandfather and this prisoner of war. So he dig his own grave, but Nazis did not execute my grandfather. They executed soldier or POW in the land next to house of my grandfather. So this is just one example. In another example of why this was important.
Do you know why they decided not to execute him in the end?
They said they're going to do this next time. So this was like a warning to do this. In another time, like when I grew up, I had a story told by my mother. Then next to house of my grandfather also, there was a big missile which fell down. And just a few meters from the house of my grandfather, but it never exploded. So I thought this is like very strange. You see missile during World War II, and until I did research later, and I found that this was actually not just single missile. There were test sites for these missiles created by Wernher von Braun, who became chief of NASA Moon program. And during World War II, he was in charge of this V2 Nazi missile program, and they tested missiles basically by launching missiles from in Poland area to basically next to civilian areas, and a lot of missiles fall in populated areas. And this is also very interesting because the launch site for these missiles were nearby from training ground for SS Galicia division. So this is just another example. And my grandfather was also put for execution by Nazis, basically, as a kind of reprisal. So he was just diving, so he was going to, again, to just for his business, again, and he was caught by Germans, and he was put for execution as a reprisal. They would have to kill civilians for reprisal for actions of partisans, and so on. And they killed each, like, 10 person or each fifth person. And my grandfather was lucky because person next to him was elected and executed. So this is like, so, and he was not involved in any war at all, no involvement, but the civilians, they suffered. So kind of, and I grew up listening to these stories, and I became interested in politics and especially like conflicts. And this is why I wanted to study them. But in the Soviet Union, it was not possible to do this. It kind of, if you did not have any recommendation from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. So I wanted to apply to study international relations, international politics, but you had to have a recommendation from the regional committee of the Communist Party. And I was not involved in any politics, I was not a party member. I was not activist in Communist League, so I could not get any recommendation. So I could not even apply. And I remember in 1985, when I became student in another university, economics university, my head of local party committee, Communist Party committee, asked me if why I'm not joining Communist Party because I am interested in politics. And I replied to her that I did not yet decide which party to join. And she told me, like, we just have one party, there's no other party to join. So this is like, that's why it was very kind of important for me to study like politics, international relations, but it was not possible. And actually, at the time, at the same faculty of international relations in Kyiv University, which was very small and only faculty in Ukraine. In Soviet Ukraine, there were two students who became politicians, like Petro Poroshenko, which is president of Ukraine, and Mikhail Saakashvili, who became president of Georgia. And now they are very active, like kind of as anti-communists, basically kind of pro-Western politicians. But they actually got recommendations from Communist Party to get accepted. And they were members of the Soviet elite. So this is just one example. And in 1988, I went to first opposition demonstration, which was held in Kyiv. And this was, again, the first legal demonstration, not by the Communist Party, or it was first opposition demonstration, which was held in Kyiv during the Soviet rule, like since 1922. So this and all the previous demonstrations were attempt to hold such demonstrations led to arrest of participants. So this is and just a few dozen people attended this rally again, which I remember, and so on. And this is actually was quite unbelievable. And I participated in all demonstrations, all rallies which were held in Kyiv when I was student, even before this became, how to say, kind of mainstream and specifically. A lot of people who now claim that they were for opposition, they never been party activists and so on. Actually, this is totally kind of incorrect because they changed their views. And now they became kind of supporters for Ukrainian independence and so on. But in fact, they were actually very different. And just to finally mention another interesting and relevant story. When I was student and at the Economics University in Kyiv, in 1990, I had to write final thesis. And I submitted my proposal to my department, and they told me that they're going to expel me from university if I would write my final thesis. Because they said, I said I'm going to write in Ukrainian. And they said, this is not a problem, you can write in Chinese. But the problem was that I said I'm going to write using Western economic theories, and that I'm going to write using Max Weber theories. And they said, this is not acceptable. You need to write what basically Soviet ideology would be.
So you couldn't talk about Max Weber too much?
Yeah, you cannot even mention. That's why I would be expelled from universities. So they told me for this. So I wrote anyway. I had to go to the library. I found a book published by classical economist, British economist, Alfred Marshall, in 1922. And I had to cut pages because nobody opened this book, which was in the library since 1922. So this is, I wrote in my thesis, again, that in Ukrainian, that a Soviet system is bound to collapse because this is inefficient. So again, they did not expel me from university because there was a perestroika and changes already, but they gave me C, like for my final thesis. So I cannot go to graduate school in the Soviet Union. So I had to wait until the Soviet collapse to go to graduate education, which I got in the United States later.
So what did you do between undergraduate and graduate school?
This is also very interesting. I became an economist in a financial department in Lutsk district. But this is also very interesting story because I was working on financial compensation for people who were expelled to Siberia, basically, on political as a political persecution. And many of them, if not most, were family members of UN and UPA. So this is basically, they were expelled for being kind of family members of UN and UPA, often young children, and they were expelled to Siberia, to Kazakhstan, and so on. And they...
Can you explain what UN and UPA is?
Yeah, so this is OUN, Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, which was then led by Bandera, Stepan Bandera, which is an organization which collaborated with Nazi Germany and was far-right organization, or even like semi-fascist or fascist organization, which invented their slogan, Glory to Ukraine, Glory to the Heroes, which has now became, again, used in Ukraine and also in the West. But this was slogan based on and greeting based on German, on Nazi greeting. They also used hand salute, which was, again, similar to Nazi salute. And they in 1943, they created UPA, which was the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, specifically a kind of partisan force, and which was responsible for ethnic cleansing and mass murder of ethnically Polish population of Volhynia, which is my, native region in Ukraine. So they killed about 50,000 Poles in Volhynia and Galicia region. And they were also fighting against Soviet authorities and killing many Ukrainians who were Soviet, supporters of Soviet government, including teachers. For instance, many teachers were killed, and any civilians, and so on. So Soviet government responded with brutal suppression, and they basically expelled anybody who was connected to UNUPA, like family members, entire family members were expelled to Siberia, and so on. And anybody who gave support, anybody who gave food them, or like put them to, kind of gave them shelter, and so on, were expelled to Siberia. And their all the property was taken out by the Soviet government, again under Stalin, Joseph Stalin. And after they were rehabilitated in 1990, they received compensation. So a lot of them came from Siberia, from Kazakhstan, and I was totally surprised because I expected they would be very hard, how to say, very kind of nationalistic. But in fact, they became assimilated. They spoke Russian. Many of them spoke Russian. And they have no kind of affinity for UN and UPA, almost with one exception, I think one who was became activist of UN and UPA, but they basically were now almost like Russians, even though they came from Ukraine.
Okay, we have to do a whole other show on that because that's really fascinating. And then you, jumping ahead a little bit, you are now, how are you seen today in Ukraine?
I think this is... In Ukraine, this is basically very interesting because I think now there is almost nothing in Ukraine about me, with the exception of now this campaign, this story about Khunka and became popular. So there were like accusations of me, again, a campaign against me in the media. Some media in Galicia region of Western Ukraine accused me basically of spreading Russian propaganda about Galicia division. And so this is, and some of them even send me death threats and so on social media. So this is like now a situation, because anything which goes against narrative is considered to be unacceptable in Ukraine. But I was given a lot of interviews in the media of Ukraine, kind of based on my research, even before. I found actually that Ukrainian mathematician here, who was, again, one of the leading Ukrainian mathematicians who was arrested and sent to Gulag and perished in Gulag, had his mathematical publications used by and translated by American inventor of electronic digital computer, who was also a mathematician and created his computer to speed up solution of mathematical and statistical equations. So this was kind of useful, and I gave a lot of interviews, publications. But after I published Maidan Massacre study in 2000, after I did Maidan Massacre study in 2014, all my property, all my house, land, and all other property was seized by the local government, by the judges, on orders from the top in retaliation for this. So I now could not travel to Ukraine, because all the property was taken away.
So your property was taken away because you wrote certain things about the Maidan massacre?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, and we're going to get into that now. But just to summarize what you said, so people are angry that you talked about who Yaroslav Khunka was. And again, we're going to get to that at the end of the episode. By the way, if you're watching this now, you get to see the whole thing. If you watch this later to see the full chat with Yvonne, you'll go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. But so you've gotten into trouble for both of those things. But in the case of the Maidan massacre, which is really a testament to how good your research is, which we're going to get into right now, you wrote things that were unpopular enough that they seized your land, your home.
Yes.
What was the justification?
So this was totally made up. This actually judges issued totally opposite decision. They first recognized me as the owner of this house, of the land, and everything. But later, I was told by my lawyers who had connections in the local courts that there was a phone call to the judge to issue such decision. And there was no evidence at all. All the evidence was in kind of in supporting of, basically, I provided testimony of my 12 neighbors who live, again, who know me. This is like house which I used. I traveled from Canada, from the United States each summer. My mother lived there. I was born there. Again, it was actually bought by my grandmother and my grandfather from the Czechs who were, again, in Czech colony, who were expelled to Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia. And after my grandparents and my mother were expelled from Poland as part of, again, ethnic cleansing in 1945. So I had all the documents, but again, this did not matter. The decision was issued specifically by the judge on order from the top, and specifically there is a strong connection between this judge's kind of decision, because the judge who was in charge of this case, kind of in charge of this court system in my Volhynian region, he was connected to the oligarch who was basically oligarch in kind of from Kolomoisky clan, and at the time Maidan snipers, some of the Maidan snipers from far-right organization became members of his party, and he was also governor of the Odessa region, kind of which, and he financed Azov, neo-Nazi Azov battalion and the right sector. So for me, basically, kind of it was kind of a very clear case of retaliation, and I still cannot return my house, even so I have all the lawyers, all the documents. So basically, this is justice system in Ukraine, and a retaliation for academic research for my study of Maidan massacre.
Okay, so obviously this is an important topic of research. One example of that being that you were retaliated against over it. So can you tell us why what happened in Maidan Square is so important, and what you allege happened, and how that differs from the official story?
And I published this already in peer-reviewed journal articles. I had two peer-reviewed journal articles published on this research. And I have also a new article, peer-reviewed journal article, which is now in final stages. It received very positive reviews from peer reviewers, anonymous. And I submitted just small changes, waiting for any time, any day for a decision. If they're going to publish, but I think it's very difficult to be certain. But based on my research, I think evidence is beyond any reasonable doubt. I think this is the case when there is no even debate, because evidence is so clear that this massacre was not conducted by snipers or by police.
For people who are watching who don't know what the massacre is, can you just set up what's happening at this point?
Yeah, this was this massacre was crucial massacre in Ukraine in 2014, in February of 2014, during Euromaidan mass protest in Kyiv and in Ukraine, which became protest against the Yanukovych government, which was pro-Russian government in Ukraine. So after the peaceful protest, which took place, kind of restarted at the end of November of 2013, became violent after because of far-right organizations' participation. This escalated to the massacre of Maidan protesters and the police on February 20th of 2014. And this massacre led to overthrow of the Yanukovych government, because he was immediately blamed for this massacre, not only by the Ukrainian by opposition, Maidan opposition, but also by the media in Ukraine and the entire world, by the Biden administration. And Biden, in his memoirs, he said that he called Yanukovych on the day of the massacre and blamed him for this massacre, and told Yanukovych that basically he have to leave not only his presidency, but also have to leave Ukraine. And for this reason, Yanukovych fled, because he also was subjected to assassination attempt, and this led to a change of the government, and this massacre basically escalated to Russian annexation of Crimea and in retaliation for this, and also to civil war in Donbass in eastern Ukraine.
So just to slow you down a second, sorry. So there's the massacre. The massacre leads to?
To overthrow of Yanukovych government.
Right, the overthrow of Yanukovych's government. And then that leads to?
To Russia annexing the Crimea region of southern Ukraine, which was pro-Russian region, and a separatist region of Russian Ukraine.
And that's in part because they imposed, or they passed, some anti-Russian language laws under the post Yanukovych government?
Yes, but I think most important it was because of the change of the government, because right. this led to the government, which was, again, anti-Russian government.
Pro-Western government.
Yes.
It defeated, right? So the pro-Russian, in quotes, guy leaves, the pro-Western guy comes in, and then Putin annexes Crimea. And then what was the next thing that it led to, did you say?
I think this is also important because Crimea was populated by ethnic Russians, so they were also like supporting Russia for a long time. And in Crimea, there was basically separatist rebellion against Ukrainian government, new Maidan government, which was supported by Russia, and which led, was connected to civil war in Donbass.
And I just want to say, not that this should matter because you're a very like esteemed academic, but I just want people to know, because this has become so politicized, you're Ukrainian, you're not a Russian Ukraine, you're not ethnically Russian. Again, I feel weird even mentioning that. I just want people to know that, because I know automatically people are going to be like, oh, he must be a Putinist. He must be a Putin propagandist. So I just want people to know that.
Yes, I'm ethnically Ukrainian from Western Ukraine, which is most anti-Russian region. And I mentioned already, I attended first opposition demonstrations in Ukraine when it was just attended by like just a few dozen people. And this was by Ukrainian Helsinki group. And at this demonstration, one female participant tried to unveil Ukrainian flag, and she was arrested by undercover agents. So this is, you know, and I have no connection to Russia at all. And I supported European Union membership of Ukraine when it was not even an issue. So I published editorials in the Kyiv Post, in Ukrainian media, calling for Ukrainian membership of European Union, because I believe this would be only a viable way for Ukraine to become democratic and to avoid breakup and to avoid a civil war. But I think this did not happen. And I always supported democracy. I always support human rights. And this is why I'm doing research about all these topics. There is no, I have no link to Russia. And I've never been to Russia. Yeah, I've been to Russia once in 1992, going to conference in Estonia, academic conference in Estonia. So this was just on my way to conference and back. So this is the only time I've been to Russia. So I have no connection to Russia at all. I do not support Russian invasion of Ukraine. I consider this illegal. But again, I'm doing this research. And I am saying what I found based on evidence and not based on politics. I think this is kind of just ridiculous to claim that anybody who says something, again, which is not supported by a mainstream narrative, is actually kind of linked to Putin and so on. This is, for me, kind of very similar to what I found during Great Terror in the Soviet Union, when people were, millions of people were arrested and accused of being spies and members of terrorist organization because they visited like Western countries even 20 years before, or they have correspondence with people in Poland or Germany or Italy or United States, or had family relatives and so on. So this was kind of similar evidence. They were arrested and denounced as enemies of the people without any actual evidence. And I think the same claims are just ridiculous and unacceptable for, again, any rational discussion.
So firmware says, please clarify how we know who initiated the massacre, which you were doing until I rudely interrupted you to preempt the Putin talking points accusations that we're going to get.
Yes, I think this was also important because for me, this is like,
That was an amazing chat, and what a great guest. And I had so many more questions, and he'll definitely come back. At least I hope he will. If you want to hear the full interview with Yvonne, which you will, make sure you go to Patreon at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. But I have another breaking news story for you that I want to make sure that you guys heard about. And I'm going to bring on to the show for a very short chat and update Zoe Alexandra, who is the co-editor of the People's Dispatch. And she's going to tell us about something that just happened now that's related to another story that we covered. So welcome, Zoe.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for coming. Tell us where you're coming from.
Yeah, I'm tuning in from Midtown Manhattan, just finishing up the workday here.
So where you were just at a protest, right? Can you tell us what you were protesting and what the story is and how it relates to the disgusting hit piece that we covered before that the New York Times wrote against people like Code Pink and the People's Forum and Tricontinental?
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, we were just outside of the New York Times offices, which, if people didn't know, is in Midtown Manhattan on 8th Avenue. And essentially, as you said, the New York Times published this hit piece in August, yesterday in India, this morning in, you know, the time zone confusion, on the morning of October 3rd. A coordinated raid took place in several cities across India, but majority of these raids took place in New Delhi, the capital. Over 100 residences were raided by the Delhi police. And these are residences of journalists and former employees of the alternative and progressive news outlet NewsClick. And they were, their houses were raided. About 50 people were brought into the police station and interrogated further. And two individuals were arrested, Prabir Purkayasa and Amit Chakraborty, who are both, Prabir is the editor-in-chief of NewsClick. Amit is one of the head administrators at NewsClick. And they're arrested under one of the most draconian and absolutely backward and ridiculous laws that exist, which is the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act in India. This is a law that essentially gives the state complete power and authority to violate people's civil liberties, to violate their right to a fair trial. People under UAPA can be accused of terrorism with no kind of legal or judicial basis, no process in court. And it's been used primarily by the Modi government, by the BJP government in recent years to attack not only journalists, but also human rights offenders, authors, et cetera. And how is this related to what we were talking about before, which is the New York Times hit piece? Well, essentially, this UAPA case was written up just about a week after the New York Times hit piece was released. And it essentially bases all of its accusations in this piece. And as I'm sure you've talked about on the show, this piece that was written by a series of New York Times journalists essentially accuses a bunch of progressive media outlets, which are anti-war, pro-working class, pro-people's movements. And in addition to that, again, oppose any sort of U.S. warmongering, whether it be against China, whether it be against all of the any of the conflicts that the U.S. Is really pursuing across the world. And it essentially accuses these outlets of being a web, a network of Chinese propaganda because they received funds from a benefactor who is an American citizen who happens to live in China. And because of this very, very thin line connection, they say, and this means that all of these outlets, which do so many things, which write about progressive movements, which speak to people in these movements, which speak out against the war, oppose imperialist propaganda. They're all, actually their entire function is just to be mouthpieces for the Chinese state, which is completely ridiculous. There's absolutely no evidence for this. And then in this raid, which took place again on the morning of October 3rd, this New York Times hit piece is essentially the only evidence that's provided to say that, yes, we can charge these people under this horrific anti-terror law because the New York Times said that they are Chinese spies. And that's going against the Indian government. That's going against et cetera. And what's interesting is that in the interrogations of all of these different journalists, contractors, designers, there was even comedians that were questioned, cartoonists, the main questions of course, they ask about funding. That's the kind of their main motive. But the majority of these questions were, did you cover the Anti-Citizenship Amendment Act protest, which took place in India in 2020? Did you cover the farmers' protest? Did you cover how India handled the COVID-19 pandemic, which for people who weren't paying attention, India had maybe the worst handling of the COVID-19 pandemic in the world? And the estimate of total dead is somewhere in the millions, even though that's not the official number that they'll share. and essentially interrogating people to see if they've ever written anything bad about the horrific human rights record of the Modi government.
So the New York Times are actually the ones acting on behalf of a foreign state government.
They seem to take up that part. Even in this hit piece, they mentioned that NewsClick had already been under investigation and targeted by Indian authorities. So this raid that took place on October 3rd, again, was not the first time NewsClick has been raided. It has been consistently targeted because it has been covering these crucial struggles in India, because it has been on the front line speaking to people who are mobilizing, who are demanding their rights, demanding their dignity. And that's why they've been consistently targeted. And even when the New York Times mentions that NewsClick is one of the many organizations that's received funds, it says that they're also currently being investigated. And it's part of this persecution from the Indian government. So they seem to acknowledge that this is part of the MO and that it has been in connection to these funds, because essentially even groups like Oxfam International have been investigated by the Indian government. BBC have been investigated and accused of, you know, all sorts of things. Oxfam had its funding completely cut. So it's any sort of organization is not safe from these attacks, saying that you can't receive foreign funding, that if you receive money from anyone outside of India, then you're going to be acting on the agenda of someone else. And New York Times clearly knew this, mentioned this, and then it is now essentially serving as the sole evidence in this ridiculous crusade against noble journalists in India.
It's just so disgusting, because all the things that they allege about others, then using that logic, these people are working on behalf of the Indian government. They're facilitating India's crackdown on independent journalists.
Yeah, I think it's so important to remind them that actually journalists have a responsibility, and that you can't just tell lies and expect there to be no consequences. And the consequences in this case are two journalists who are in prison, are 100 colleagues who have been had their house raided, have had their laptops and phones seized, who have been, you know, terrorized, scared. These are people who are young as 20 years old, who, you know, have never really experienced something like this before. And this is, again, I mean, it's also because of the Indian government and because they're cracking down on journalists. But the New York Times is playing a huge role in this, and to not acknowledge that. And they even ran a piece today about the raid, and they even acknowledged that it was their own piece that in part motivated this. You see these right wing figureheads like Amit Shah using the New York Times piece. It was all over Indian media, just serving as this complete legitimate kind of legitimizing everything that they had wanted to do. They want to call left journalists agents. They want to say they're anti-national, when they're really the people who are fighting for the Indian working class, for the future, you know, for people to be able to live in this country so it can be a country that's not destroyed by climate change, destroyed by corporate greed, destroyed by these people who are only thinking of the most wealthy and the most privileged in the country.
Yeah, and here they have it. I just want to show that article that they actually, where they kind of acknowledge their role, not in an at all apologetic way, just as if it was an appropriate thing to do. Let's see. So we have New Delhi police raid homes and offices of journalists. The sweep caught up the founder and contributors of a left-leaning news website, according to other news outlets and those raided. A Times investigation had linked the site to a pro-China network.
Yeah. So
I hope they're happy.
Hope they're happy.
That's so disgusting. And again, all of this is guilt by association. There's never any evidence of anything criminal. The most that they can do is kind of try to insinuate these like Orientalist, racist smears against people that are so reminiscent of the Cold War and the McCarthy era.
Yeah, and it's like they don't understand why people wouldn't want war with China, or why they would want the truth about what's happening. And it's like, it's not, you don't have to be influenced by a foreign government to know that war is not a good thing.
Right. It's projection, because these people are such mercenaries that they can't imagine having an idea that wasn't either popular or monetarily compensated. And here, again, just looking at their actual coverage of it, Again, 2 months ago, the New York Times published an investigation that connected NewsClick to an international network that funds pro-China propaganda, along with other material. Ms. Christian said that the Times coverage of NewsClick and the funding network had left her concerned that the Modi government would weaponize the story as an excuse, as a pretext for fresh attacks on journalists who are doing very important work. And of course, she was right. So yeah, shout out to the Times. I mean, I wonder what it was like for them to write that, to add that in there.
Yeah, it can't have, I mean, how many times have they paved the way for war crimes that then they inevitably have to cover? It's one of many, I think.
Yeah, well, they really helped create the story. We should give them credit for that.
Give them some props for that.
Well, anything else that you want to make sure we know about? Anything we can do to support these journalists?
We'll keep following NewsClick, follow People's Dispatch. We're going to be giving updates about what's happening. We're going to be launching a statement for journalists, communicators, and media houses to sign on to. We really need all your support. It's so important to stand with our colleagues at this point. An attack against one is an attack against all. And we can't stay silent when people are being criminalized for the act of telling the truth. And that the journalism that the people at NewsClick are doing is such brave and important journalism. We have to be paying attention to the farmer struggles in India. We have to be paying attention to the bold trade unions who are organizing in the face of, labor rights being taken away during the pandemic. There's just so much that we have to be grateful to these journalists for uncovering and for telling and for really doing it in the spite of so much repression. And so I really encourage people to check out NewsClick, check out People's Dispatch, which we'll be covering in a consistent way what's happening on the ground there.
And where can people find People's Dispatch?
At People's Dispatch on all platforms and peoplesdispatch.org.
Are you on Twitter?
Yes, at Zoe Pepper C.
Okay, Zoe Pepper C. We'll put it in the description. Thank you so much, Zoe.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time!